speaker was scheduled to be Jean-Luc Yannick with the USDA ARS in Ithaca, New York, but he had a family emergency and had to leave. So I'm a co-author on this talk, so I'm going to go ahead and give the talk for him. I just saw the slides yesterday for the first time, so if I'm a little rough, please forgive me. Let's see, I'll ask the previous speakers to return the favor and keep time for me so we stay on schedule. This is the last presentation before the break, so it's particularly important that we end on time. Okay, go. what I'll be presenting is our studies on association mapping loci for beta-glucan content in oat, and we took advantage of historical uniform performance nursery data to achieve these results. And I just need to acknowledge the people who actually did the work. So Mark and Franco are two great graduate students who physically work in my lab in Ames, but receive most of their guidance from Jean-Luc with a weekly teleconference, and it's been working surprisingly well with that arrangement. And then Nick and Charlene work with the uniform oat nursery trials that we use for our data. A couple of other acknowledgments with the diversity arrays technology is we use DART markers for our genotyping, and Bill Beavis at Iowa State University is the official major professor of Mark and Franco and contributes to this work as well. And then we received our funding from a USDA NEPA grant. So In the talk, then, I'll start with just a little bit of information about beta-glucans and what cooperative nurseries are in the public breeding sector, and then talk about how we identified loci to learn more about the methods of beta-glucan accumulation in oat, and identifying natural variation for beta-glucan content absent from elite, that's supposed to be oat germplasm. Our design allowed us to determine what's missing in elite germplasm that might be targets for introgression. And then, I'll conclude with a proposed plan to rapidly increase beta-glucan content through breeding in oat. So beta-glucans are soluble fiber that accumulates in many small grains, and it has some of the best supported health claims of any compound out there. So many countries have issued health claims about beta-glucan. It's particularly good for vascular health, and the mechanism is thought to be that it increases the viscosity of the digesta. So it enables things to move through our digestive system easily, and then it also has some affinity for some detrimental compounds, cholesterol and this kind of thing. So it helps move these detrimental compounds through our digestive system. The structure of beta-glucan is not extremely well known, but the key is that it has these beta-1-3-1-4 linkages that aren't digestible by alpha amylases, that's why it remains undigested. And then, other than that, the structure is variable. So the carbohydrate chains are of various lengths, and they have different ratios of linkages, and as well as distributions of the 1-3 and 1-4 branches. Beta-glucans are almost unique to grasses. I'm not sure what the exception to that rule is. Probably there are some microbes that make some similar carbohydrates. And very little is known about the biosynthesis of these compounds other than the cellulose cellulosynthase-like F family of genes is involved in their biosynthesis. So the uniform oat performance nurseries are a great resource for this work. There are about 12 breeding programs that participate in these nurseries. They each send 3 to 6 of their best experimental lines for trial every year. So this is about 40 lines that are produced every year in this nursery. And these lines are grown at 20 locations. So we're getting a lot of observations on these materials. The idea is that if you have a variety that performs well in the uniform oat performance nursery, that it's a good candidate for variety release. And the great thing about this system is that there's a large repository of data on the elite spring oat population in North America. And then the cooperators maintain seeds of the line going back to 15 years. So we have seeds and data from a large amount of material that was grown in a lot of different environments. So the material that we used for our association study then is 446 lines that were grown in this uniform oat performance nursery from 1994 to 2007. So there are 2,300 high-quality beta-glucan records over spanning 12 years, evaluated in 129 different environments, and then we regrew those lines in Ames in 2009 and 2010 and reevaluated the beta-glucan content using a rapid high-throughput method that we developed in our lab. And then we genotyped these lines using DART markers. So oats is kind of lagging behind other cereals with the development of marker technology, and DART was the best marker type for the that we had at the time we started the project. It's a presence-absence hybridization-based marker, and it's being supplanted by sequence-based markers as more genome sequence information is available on oats. So the elite uniform oat performance nursery is kind of one half of our study. The other part of our study is a more broad based collection of oats that is from the National Small Grains Collection. So this material is not elite. It has a lot of wilder types of germplasm in it, but there's 6,000 accessions that have been evaluated for beta-glucan content as well. So we have a lot of data from here. We used the beta-glucan data that's present in Grin to select the upper and lower tails of this collection. And then we reevaluated these lines in Ames in 2009, 2010 again. And this plot just shows the selections that we made from the germplasm collection. So the Grin beta-glucan measurement is on the bottom. We selected the tails of those for regenotyping in Ames. So that's why there's nothing in the middle here. And then our regenotyping in Ames is on the y-axis here. So you can see there is a correlation between our data and the Grin beta-glucan content, even though they're produced in different environments. So, my favorite part of the presentation, the statistical approach that Jean-Luc applied to this. Okay, so we had to account for population structure, as always in association mapping, to avoid spurious associations, and that is done just with another term in the model that's not shown here. But the method that Mark and Franco used was this lasso method. It's a penalized regression method, and it is particularly well suited to association mapping because within association mapping, you have the problem of having a large number of predictors or marker data and then few observations. So that would be individuals in your populations. And the problem that you always have in that kind of case is you risk overfitting your model. Well, the reason lasso works well is that it has the model is based on the regression term. So the betas are marker effects, and the model has this regression term, but then it also has this penalization term where any marker effect that is large is kind of minimized in the model. So we're often large marker effects are associated with error, and so the number of the actual markers that are used in the model are kind of minimized by this process. So that's the model that we used. And in the end, we wound up associating a bunch of markers with statistical significance in both of the studies that we did. And you'll see that none of these markers are common to both lists. So part of this is because of the DART system. We didn't overlap. All the markers didn't overlap between the two systems. But you know, it may be also that different genes are associated with the trait in the two populations that we examined. So to try to focus our attention on what was most likely to be real and important, we compared the association mapping data with previous QTL studies. So the blue and green points here are QTL identified in previous studies. And then these triangles denote the location, not the magnitude or direction, of the markers that we found in our association study. So you can see there's some concordance with previous studies here, which was encouraging to us, so particularly here and here. To try to understand what kind of genes we were looking at, Mark did this alignment of our markers to the BLAST genome. So the OAT genome hasn't been sequenced yet. We don't even have all our markers mapped yet. So we relied on the map that's well developed in Rice. And what Mark did was just he did a keyword test on the annotations, a keyword search on the annotations of all the genes in Rice. And so all the red crosses on this graph represent a gene that has glucan in its annotation. Okay, so not all of them are associated with beta glucan, but some of them may be associated with beta glucan biosynthesis. And then the blue hits, the blue crosses are our association, significant associations with this is the broader germplasm collection. So the more wild material. And then the green crosses are the elite germplasm hits. So a couple of things that you can see from this immediately. Well, Mark was very excited when he noticed this concordance here between, these are the CLSF gene cluster in Rice, and he has a couple of markers that landed right on top of that gene cluster in oats. And then the other thing to note is that there's not a lot of agreement between the elite material and the more exotic material. Yeah, so there's that gene cluster we're interested in. So our take-home messages are some associations they align closely with QTL from previous studies, with linkage mapping studies. And there appears to be a little overlap between associations in the elite population versus the global population. So one reason this could be is that our study is underpowered. It may be that we're just not detecting all the associations that are present, and so we're not seeing the ones that are in common. Another possibility is that actually there is no concordance between the two different populations. And this would be interesting because we may be missing important genes in the elite material that we could introduce from the global population into that elite material and improve the elite material further. And then we were pleased to see evidence of polymorphism at CSLF locus, at least in one of the two populations, suggesting that our association studies maybe are really identifying things that are meaningful. So this is the scheme that Jean-Luc proposes to do breeding, to do rapid improvement of beta-glucan content. And it's a genomic selection approach whereby we develop a training population that is both genotyped and phenotyped and used to develop a model. And then that model is applied to our breeding material, which is genotyped as well. And using the model, then we calculate a breeding value term that is actually this is what you would select upon in your breeding program, a genomic estimated breeding value, and you would make your selections based on the model. So it's important to emphasize here that the phenotyping is still critical. Our model will only be as good as our phenotypes, but our phenotyping in this model, in this approach, is not used to make selections. The phenotyping is used to build the model, and it's the model that is used to make selections. Okay, so then our selections feed back into the breeding program here, and every cycle we get new genotyping and phenotyping data that can be used to update our model and make it more robust. So this is kind of, I guess, describes the philosophy of this approach, where you start with biological inputs, so genes and traits that you're interested in, and these genes are acted upon by nature to produce observed responses. So these could be thought of as the phenotypes that you actually observe in your material. And one approach you might take is to ask, well, can we understand why, using the X information, for example, the genotype information, and the process of regression helps us do that. And you can actually begin to develop hypotheses about how X is translated into Y, how your phenotype is developed. But for genomic selection to work, you don't have to understand it. All you need to do is predict it. So even if you treat this as a black box, as long as you have an association between X and Y, you can still use that to make a prediction, and it's still still valuable for breeding anyway. So this is the approach that we're taking. So we tried to guess how much our progress might look like from an approach like this, and these are some graphs that Franco made to look at the correlations between the predicted values in our model and the actual phenotypes we observed. And so on the y-axis are the correlation coefficients. I guess I should point out there's two lines on each graph. They did the modeling with two different methods, Bayesian methods and then RR-BLUP. And each of those methods is plotted on the graph. And the fact, the observation that the two lines are fairly parallel suggests that what we're looking at is not just an artifact of the method that we're using. It seems to be based on the data. So what Franco did was he took a training set. This is using only the most recent data. The data produced since 2007. This is the correlation he got. Then he included a broader training set that included data back to 1998. So we're including older data, but our training set is larger. And the correlation went up. And the trend continued with data going back to 1994. So this trend was observed with several traits. And with more complex traits, the heritability goes down. So you can see that, and the trend doesn't hold true quite as well. And this is largely because we have more G by E with these traits. The conclusion that we draw from this is that the older data is still valuable in your training set. So it increased the correlation of our predicted versus actual data. So it emphasizes the importance of keeping that old data. So let's see. So the phenotypes from the uniform nursery were valuable. even though they were collected years ago, and they increase, they add value to our training set. Let's see. So the, I guess the practical implications of this is that to really fully take advantage of the potential whenever you of your phenotyping efforts, you should keep some seed from what you phenotype, even if you don't have time or facility or resources to genotype it. That old material is potentially valuable, and if you can just keep a few seeds, you know, it can potentially contribute to somebody's association model down the road. And then the novel thing about this genomic selection approach is that you know, breeders historically have evaluated lines. Now we're talking about evaluating alleles, and this creates a completely different approach that you would take in evaluating material then, because you're interested in the alleles, and the lines just become carriers of alleles. So the unit that is important for replicating is not necessarily the lines if your goal is to model the effect of the alleles. The unit of replication is that allele, and you want to observe the alleles and admit in as many different genomic contexts as you can so that you can build an accurate model of its effect. So that means that you have a lot of flexibility in evaluation of lines across treatments and environments. So I'll just give a quick example here. So if you had six lines that you wanted to evaluate in 20 locs and two reps, it would take 240 plots. If you were evaluating alleles, the recommendation that Jean-Luc would propose is that you should submit 240 lines and put each different line in a plot. Because those lines have many alleles in common, you're going to get a lot of replication in alleles, and you'll be observing many more alleles, and it would give you a lot more power to develop your models. So I guess I'll end there. I don't have a conclusion slide, but I think the bottom line here is that, you know, I think we've kind of laid the groundwork for doing association genetics in oats, and we feel like there's a good potential for moving the trait along with this method.